Hola, hola, everybody. It's Dr. J-Flow. As you may already know, we had the opportunity to host our second in-person event to celebrate the closing of Latinx Heritage Month. In this episode is the result of that event, and I'm so happy that you get to listen to it, even if you were not able to meet us in person. You will hear lots of laughs from the audience and some of their voices too as we open the floor for questions. I hope this makes you feel like you were there supporting us. That's it. That's all I wanted to tell you. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And remember, unidos somos más.
I think that my motivation is to make Rice University a place where I would like my daughter to study. Where I think that she would be happy, that she would be treated like everybody should be. So I think that the main motivation is that.
Welcome to Latinx Can, a podcast showcasing Latinx professionals who turn their dreams into realities. I'm your host, la doctora Yenire Flores Delgado, and today I'm here with Dr. Angel Marti, the first Latino to chair the chemistry department at Rice University, who aims to make the department accessible to all. And he is here to tell you, si se puede, my friends, si se puede. Dr. Angel Marti, the first thing that we always ask in the podcast is, tell us about your story and where your story begins.
Well, first of all, thank you for the kind invitation to you and Agustin. It is a real pleasure to be here in the podcast. I have listened to many of your episodes, and so I'm a big fan. So thank you. So I was born, I'm not going to say how many years ago, but a few, 20 years ago. And in a town in Puerto Rico. So Puerto Rico is an island in the Caribbean, and I was born in Utuado, Puerto Rico. And Utuado is right in the center of the island, in the mountains. And, a very rural area, a lot of plantations, coffee plantations, oranges. My grandparents, that's what they did. They were farmers, and my parents too. My parents, up to this day, they grow coffee. And they grow oranges in Puerto Rico. But my parents, in addition to that, they got the chance to go to college. Mm-hmm. So I'm not a first generation student, although I'm first generation in science. So my dad studied education and my mother studied accounting. To be an accountant. So, and they both worked, but they has this wonderful idea to start a family, and they had four boys. So yeah, I have three brothers, which is crazy. I mean, it's not great. I mean, they're wonderful. Right?
Yeah, but a very active household.
No. They're wonderful and accomplished, but growing up, it was noisy and we're always fighting, but fighting in a good way, right? Like siblings.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know you, but I engaged in some fights with my sister.
I always liked sciences. And I used to have my own laboratory. So all houses in Puerto Rico, back in the day, rural Puerto Rican area. So we didn't have water, running water. We had to go to the river to get water. But, we'll have a kind of like a community aqueduct, and mm-hmm. we'll get water like one or twice a week or so. And we'll have to collect water and stuff. But showers and bathrooms were outside the house. So they were not connected to the house. I mean, the old houses. So eventually my grandparents built a bathroom mm-hmm. connected to the house. And then there was this bathroom that was made of zinc and wood that they didn't use anymore. So I made that my laboratory. Today I will mix stuff there, aluminum and acid from battery cards and stuff like that. And it was perfect because since it was a bathroom, it has its own safety shower. So in case that something happened, right? So it was great. Then I went to school and my parents knew that I had this interest in science and mathematics, but they kind of like inferred that if I would stay in the barrio, probably I would not get the education that I needed. So then they sent me to a different school when it was time to go to high school. Mm-hmm. Then they sent me to a different school. We was in a town that was next door. But remember, we're talking about Puerto Rico, rural area, yep. A lot of the very bad roads. And I had to be at class at 7 a.m. in the morning. So I will hitchhike every morning.
Wow.
So my parents would leave me at the gas station. There was a little gas station at the entrance of the barrio, and I would stay there, and eventually someone would pass and would take pity on me. I would
go,
and they would take me to Lares, which was where the high school was. Mm-hmm. But then there, I had the opportunity to get into advanced courses, particularly mathematics. I actually took up to calculus there, and that was wonderful. And since I like math so much, then I started to participate in competitions across the island, and I started to win. So I went to the Olympics, to the math Olympics in Brazil, and I was like last place in the Olympics.
I know that feeling. It's that feeling where you feel like, okay, I'm kicking everybody's butt at school. I'm like, you know, top three student every day. And then what happened to me is that I went to an international school in Southern Africa, and I was like, oh, I'm smart. You know, I just forgot that I was smart in Spanish and not so much in English. And so then everybody that was in that school was like way more intelligent than me. And also spoke English. And I was like, okay, well, maybe, you know, maybe I'm not that great.
But it was a great experience. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was the first time I traveled without my parents. Mm-hmm. And I traveled to a different country, and I met, you know, a lot of wonderful people. And it was a unique experience for mm-hmm. me. And that was kind of like the end of high school. So then I started college, and I always thought that I would be a mathematician. In my mind, I was successful doing math. So I thought, no, math is the way to go. Actually, to be completely honest, I entered. So my first major was pre-med. So I was a pre-med major.
Yeah.
And that lasted a week.
What happened that made you change your mind?
Something superfluous. But, you know, sometimes coincidences are important. And I went to this orientation that the president of the university and the provost, you know, talked to students in this big amphitheater with 300 people, right? For only natural sciences. And the president of the university asked, well, how many of you want to study medicine? And then I swear that, you know, about 90% of that amphitheater raised their hand.
Right.
And I said, well, maybe I don't want to do that. You know, everybody's going to be a doctor, maybe I want to do something else, something different.
Yeah.
And that's how it started. So that same day, well, not that same day, but, you know, that same week, I went to the registrar and changed my concentration. And I talked to my parents, right? And I said, well, I'm not going to be a doctor anymore. I'm going to be a mathematician. And they looked at me, said, but they didn't look at me because I was talking on the phone. But I could feel them looking at me and saying, you don't know what you're doing. Because of course, I mean, again, their preparation was not in science, right? So I was really the first person in the family that go to school with a science career in mind. They said, you cannot do that because you graduate with a math bachelor degree, and then where are you going to work in Puerto Rico? Well, now I know that there were options, right? But back in the day, then I thought, maybe that's true. So then I thought, well, I always liked doing experiments and doing, you know, and chemistry has physics in it. And that's the thing. So you start college, you think that you know what chemistry is, but you don't. You think that you know what physics is, you really don't, right? So it's throughout the experience and taking classes and going in there that you really discover all these things.
Yeah.
So I changed to chemistry really without knowing the whole world.
Yeah. And I want to go back to something you just said about the example of how about 90% of the people in that auditorium wanted to study medicine. And you said, well, that's too many people. You know, all of them are going to have to compete for the medical jobs. And I'm just maybe going to find something else that doesn't have too much competition, right? I think the point there is thinking strategically, because we all think that we just have to work hard and hard and hard and just try as hard as we can. And then sometimes, yes, the hard work is important, but sometimes it's even more important to be strategic about how you approach something. I remember, for example, taking my CUMS. I think it was in grad school, we had to take 15 CUMS and pass 5 cumulative exams, right? And then I was going for organic polymer chemistry. And somebody told me, one of my classmates in my lab said, oh, you really should like try to do as many organic chemistry CUMS as possible. But then I heard the department head when he talked to us and he said, you just have to pass 5 you don't have to pass the organic chemistry ones only. And I was like, so my first QM, I just jumped in. And then it was like, I just looked at all five QMs that were being offered. And I was like, well, I can probably answer 40% of the organic chemistry one, or I can maybe answer 60% of the analytical one. And there's less analytical people here. So maybe I'll get the curve, you know, like they'll bump me up. I got a B. And I think, yes, one down, you know? So I think is that's what's coming from that experience is that, yes, hard work is important, but sometimes strategy is also really important. It gets you there. It helps you just move that needle a little further. So then you decided to enroll in the chemistry courses and then pursue a bachelor's in chemistry, right? And then went on to try to pursue a PhD in chemistry.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit more about how you decided to go for a PhD. And then what was that story of you actually trying to get admitted into the PhD program? Because it wasn't a straightforward one, right?
No, but that's a long story. I'm going to try to make it very, very short. So the second year that I was in college, I saw some postings about research through the Alliance for Minority Participation. So I went to the office of the Alliance for Minority Participation, and turns out that I found Professor Javier Figueroa, which to this day, he's a great friend of mine, ours, right? Right. You know Javier, Javier as well. And of course, I was late, last day of applications for the program, and all the, not the good labs, because my lab was great. All the popular labs were taken, right? So I told Javier, Javier said, well, you know, there is a new professor, relatively new professor, that is starting. He's from Calle, Puerto Rico, also from the mountains of Puerto Rico and the rural area. And he has space in the lab. I'm going to introduce you to him, and then you can talk, and then you can see how things go. And exactly that same day, I met Jorge. I walked into a research laboratory for the very first time. And that's the thing. You have a preconception about how a chemistry lab is without ever being in one. And I don't know. So for all of you that are listening to me, I don't know if you remember when you, for the first time, enter a laboratory.
I thought it was ugly.
I thought it was awesome. I started to see all these machines and HPLC. Oh my God, that looked like it was coming out from Star Trek. Right? A fluorometer, a spectrometer, and then the hoods and the chemical reactions going in there. It was like a dream. And I thought, wow, finally I made it. I'm here. And finally I can do something that I have always dreamt of doing. So since the first time I stepped on the lab, I knew that that's what I wanted to do the rest of my life. And then I eventually figured out, well, if you want to keep doing this, you have to The best way is to do a PhD. Mm-hmm. And then if you want to have your own lab one day, you need to be a professor.
Right.
Right. So that's how I decided to apply to grad school. Mm-hmm. So the short story about how I got to be in grad school was that, well, I applied to grad school, right? And I applied to the University of Puerto Rico, Rio Piedras, because that was the only thing that I knew. Again, my parents did have their degrees and they were successful in their profession, but they were not scientists, right? So they could not advise me in that way. And if I would have known that I had options, like, for example, to apply here to the United States and to come here, do a PhD, I would certainly have done it. So then I applied and I thought, well, you know, I've been doing research and I'm good at it. And
humble. No, I've been doing confident. It's good.
Well, I need to build myself up for what I'm going to say next. And it is that I got a rejection letter. So I didn't get admitted to grad school, right? Mm-hmm. So for the first time in my life, I thought I knew what I wanted to do, right? And I thought I had a path. And then I thought somehow that I was entitled to it, to get admissions to grad school because I knew the professors. I was working there. It was just kind of like a natural transition, but then I did, right? And to this day, I'm not 100% sure why not. Mm-hmm. So my grades were not the best the first two semesters, but they improved over the years. And actually I got A's in physical chemistry, inorganic chemistry, instrumental analysis. So I was doing well, but I didn't get admitted. So I thought that there was nothing I could do, right? Mm-hmm. But that's the other thing. That's the other mistake.
Right.
There's a lot of things that you can do, but I didn't know. I didn't even tell my parents that I didn't get into grad school. And then I kept going to school, but I didn't have a plan. And one day I remember that I was walking through natural sciences, the school, and I saw one of the professors that gave me instrumental analysis, analytical chemistry. And he saw me and then he said, he waved and he said, hey, everything good with you? Did you get admitted to grad school? Mm-hmm. Because he was one of the professors that gave me a recommendation letter. I said, actually, no. I got a rejection letter. So I'm not going to grad school. Then he looked at me and said, no, that's impossible. He said, well, no, it's true. If I had the letter here, I would show it to you. And he said, now, don't worry about it. I'm going to talk today to the director of the graduate program. Come to my office in the afternoon after 5, and then we'll talk.
Yeah.
So I went to his office at 5, and he said, well, I talked to the guy. He said that if you are able to get an A in physical chemistry, then you will get admitted.
Okay. Was that quantum chemistry?
It was quantum, yeah.
Isn't that challenging?
Well, but it turns out that math was something that I understood, right? Mm-hmm. So and I said, well, I accept the challenge. Well, actually, the deal was a little bit different. The deal was, well, if you get an A in physical chemistry, you will get a good standing admission. If you get a B or less, then you will get a conditional admission with the condition that you will take physical chemistry during grad school.
Oh, okay.
Right? Yeah. And I get a passing grade. So there was a path. I said, fine, I accept the challenge. So I studied very hard and I got an A in physical chemistry. So I got a conditional acceptance into grad school.
And this brings me to my next point, right? Because doing a PhD, it's hard. It already is a hard thing. So don't feel like if you're struggling right now, if you're a student going through a PhD, it's normal. But there's a light at the end of the tunnel, I promise you. And then what I want to put into perspective, though, is that you did your PhD at the University of Puerto Rico, where it's a place that has less resources than the continental U.S., than many countries in Latin America also have less resources. And I wanted to hear from you, what was it like for you to do a PhD at the University of Puerto Rico when you have to worry about strikes at the university, where you have to worry about ordering your reagents and they come in 3 months at a time, and then compare that to what you are able to offer your students today here at Rice University?
Yeah, we can do a podcast only on that, right?
Yeah.
So living in Rio Piedras, it was an adventure. So I don't know how it is today, but I got assaulted once, my brother twice.
Like robbed?
Robbed. Yeah. Right? That's what I meant.
Yeah.
that's what the word that I was looking for in my mind. I got robbed once. My brother got robbed twice. Mm-hmm. So it was a kind of like a dangerous neighborhood. And the university itself, it was not in a good condition. Mm-hmm. Actually, the University of Puerto Rico right now is not in a good condition. And particularly the building where the research building, the Facundo Hueso building, was not in good conditions. The elevators were broken most of the time. If you will order anything, and that was not related necessarily to the condition of the building, but rather to Puerto Rico itself, it would take months for anything that you will order to arrive.
Right.
You had to be inventive. You had to predict what you will need for your experiments, because you make an order once a month, and then that probably is, right?
Right.
So here at Rice, we have a chem store, a stockroom there that have 50% of all the things that you need, and the others, you just order them and you will get them in a couple of days, right? So, but there were a couple of things. For example, you could get ether from kind of like a stockroom that we have, the shipping and receiving department. Mm-hmm. And there's a story about the ether. So it was all ether, right?
Old
ether in a big canister, and was full of water. Of course. And people will take ether from there. And now that I'm a professor and I think about it, I mean, were we crazy? And then, but that's the thing, right? So I remember that I have been in two explosions. Yeah. None of them have done them. So, but I've been there. And, you know, all ether with water and you don't know. And a student was distilling ether and forgot to kill the peroxide and left for lunch, right? And the only person that was in the lab was me.
Oh my.
And it was in a basement, right? And so no windows where you can escape or anything. There was a door behind me, and there was an HPLC, and I was working on the HPLC. In the other room, there was a hood that was the ceiling. And of course, you know, it happens that the beaker and everything exploded. The hood exploded. And when I hear the explosion, I remember the explosions, wow. Right? I remember looking up and seeing things trembling. I swear that I saw the shockwave coming through me.
Yeah. Like in the movies.
Yeah. And the shockwave actually, and I tell this story to my friends and they still don't believe me because the shockwave broke the door. And the door, it was a metallic door, an aluminum door. And there was a security door after, and it really destroyed it, like took it out of the cement where it was hanging.
Oh, wow. Yeah. From the hinges
or everything. Yeah. Right. So my friends at this day, they think that I was so scared that the ether and the explosion gave me superpowers and that I tried to exit that door and broke the door. But then I couldn't break the other one. So then I escaped through another exit. So at this day, I stick to my version. I don't know who broke the door. And I swear that I don't have any superpowers rather than being extremely distracted.
Yeah. And the reason why I bring this up is because it talks about the resilience and the creativity that happens when you have little resources. In Spanish, we say, la necesidad es la madre de la invención, right? Necessity is the mother of invention. And so I want to bring it up because every student from Puerto Rico I've met in here in the mainland knows more chemistry than me by like a fivefold. And they are so resourceful. And it's what you get from having to go earning a PhD in an environment that has less resources than anybody else. And so when you come here and then it comes into sort of like the land of abundance, like my lab, I was completely 100% spoiled by Dr. Woolley. I never had to worry about one reactant coming into my lab. So I just want to acknowledge that. And also tied up to people from Latin roots growing up in the country, right? Sometimes we don't have access to information. Sometimes our parents don't have a lot of resources and they figure out how to put food on the table, right? But just remember that those experiences is what makes you unique, what makes you different. And you always have that to fall into. Is that sort of, I call it a chip that you activate in your brain that just takes you to the next level. I mean, you have to figure it out. You know that when there's little, you still can make it happen. So just remember that, because if there's going to be challenges in your life, and then all you have to do is like, okay, I got it. You know, we figured it out before. So just something to keep in mind. And so then after you graduated with your PhD from the University of Puerto Rico, that was in 2004, you joined Professor Nicolas Turo's lab as a postdoctoral research fellow at Columbia. And in 2008, then you came here, you became an assistant professor here at Rice. And since then you became an associate professor in 2015 and then a full professor in 2020.
Yes.
So that's a long career in the academy. Can you talk more about the obstacles that you have surpassed throughout your career so far? And do you think your cultural background has been part of those obstacles that you've faced?
Yeah. So interestingly, getting a postdoc and a faculty position was not that difficult. Mm-hmm. And the message here is exactly what you were saying, that when I was going to apply for postdocs, I already had a mentor, Jorge, that told me what I needed to do and that told me all the tricks, right? So now I had information.
Right.
And privilege information. That's what we call privilege, right?
Right.
In a certain way.
Absolutely.
So I had that privilege that someone that has gone through the experience and told me you need to do this. These are the people that you need to contact. And that was extremely helpful. Right. And the same thing when I was looking for faculty positions. Uh-huh. Actually, I can say that the first time that I applied to faculty positions, I didn't get any. But that was my fault. I applied only to two places, right? And then I told Nick Turo, that was my postdoctoral advisor, you know, I only got two. I didn't get any offers. Actually, I didn't get any interviews. Mm-hmm. Nothing.
No, well.
And he said, well, how many applications you sent? I said, well, two. He looked at me and said, well, you missed by an order of magnitude.
Right.
So next year I sent 40.
Wow.
And I got 10 interviews. But that's the game. At this stage, it's a numbers game, I think. And that worked out. And there have been obstacles along the road. I think that education is a big equalizer too, and help to put you at the level so people don't doubt that much about you. But I can tell the story. I'm not going to mention agencies, right?
Sure. Tell us the story. We want the help, the gossip.
Yeah. So I submitted a grant to this agency, and Rice University is wonderful. So Rice University has an office that is called the Office of Proposal Development. So I spent 4 years as a postdoc, and I wrote my thesis in English. So I can write, I think, well in English. Mm-hmm. 4 years as a postdoc, I have written all my papers, right? I think I can write.
Yeah, I think that I support that.
I don't want to be cocky.
So no, it's okay. I didn't come off like that this time.
So, okay, thanks. have to be careful, you know, this has been broadcasted. So I sent this proposal and it was not funded. And in the comments, one of the reviewers, I'm sure that today they will filter these comments, mm-hmm. but there was a comment that said, this proposal is full of errors, orthographic errors, extremely difficult to read. I couldn't get the idea. I stopped reading halfway through. The proposal was well written at the first time, but even though it passed through the Office of Proposal Development,
yeah, like that has
PhDs in science and English that check your proposals. Mm-hmm. That proposal was fantastic. Actually, about a year ago, I just out of curiosity, I went out and looked at it, and it was perfect. So Someone in the panel thought that because I have a Latin name, mm-hmm. then my proposal could not be well put mm-hmm. together, or will have to have a lot of mistakes. Right. And, you know, you think that these things don't happen, but mm-hmm. still happen, right? And that was when I was back and an assistant professor. Mm-hmm. So that certainly, and I think that the agencies in general have improved a lot. Certainly most agencies have training for biases and unconscious biases. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that, you know, we all have them. And the important thing is to be conscious about them and mm-hmm. to remediate them. People that say, I don't have any, those are the ones that...
Yeah, the worst. Yeah. No, I totally agree. And like you said, it's the key is to become more aware, right? Like we all have them. And then the key is for us to push ourselves a little as well and try to be self-critical and say, okay, where can I improve? What can I do? Because it's not like we have biases against our own group sometimes, right? Latinos are notorious for wanting to be sort of more critical of other Latinos. There's an analogy, right? Like the crabs in the bucket story where one crab is trying to get out of the bucket and then the other crabs are trying to just hold them back because one can get ahead. I haven't experienced that too much. I think that's a little bit of an exaggeration as well. But what I have seen is that sometimes we don't support each other as much as we could support each other. Sometimes we fall into our own flags, right? Oh, I'm Puerto Rican or I'm Venezuelan. And then, you know, that person is Mexican. They might not represent me, but we have a lot of things in common. And then I think the idea is for us to really support each other. And then when one rises, the other one comes along, right? It's not just one person that makes it to the top. Because as you're talking, education is a big equalizer. But when you have the credentials, then the opportunities are not just based on credentials anymore. The opportunities are based on who you know and who can give you access to other opportunities that you don't even know exist, right? And so once you get to the credentials and you checked all the boxes, all you have is the network. It's who do you reach out to learn about something different? Who can give you the advice of, mm-hmm. oh, I'm going to interview for chair of department. You know, who do I call so that I can prepare for this? That's where the unconscious biases play even a bigger role. Because now you can't say, oh, you don't have a degree. No, I have a degree. So why are you allowing me this opportunity? Right? So I think that that's really important. But now you are the first Latino to lead the chemistry department at Rice University. This is a remarkable achievement, given that Latinos made up only 8% of all advanced degrees holders in the United States in 2021 by the Pew Research Center. And of those 8%, only 10% of that 8% holds a PhD, right? So I just want to take a moment to recognize the achievement. that you have got so far. And then I want to ask you, what motivated you to pursue this career path as a school administrator? And what were some of the key steps that you've taken to get to where you are today?
Yeah, so I think that not only about being a school administrator or a chair of the chemistry department, but also about the different activities that I'm involved. Like, for example, I'm the faculty director of the Rice Emerging Scholar Program, which is a program for disadvantaged students, first generation, low income. And I think that my motivation is to make Rice University a place where I would like my daughter to study, where I think that that she will be happy, that she will be treated like everybody should be. So I think that the main motivation is that doing research is something that I feel very passionate about, right? The discovery and the conversations that I have with my students and the interesting thing that they find. So I could do that all my life. And actually, I'm still doing it
right. Because
I really enjoy it. But when you take on leadership positions, they give you the opportunity to do something that will impact a larger number of people. And to have a legacy, something that you build, something that have your thoughts of how things can be different.
Yep.
And I say different because at the end, they don't necessarily have to be better, but you hope that they will be better.
Yeah.
Right.
Hopefully. I think hopefully everybody that steps up to lead tries to make it better for somebody else. But what I was going to say is lately I've been having conversations with people for the podcast that have been more advanced in their careers. They are towards the end of their careers. One of them is the CEO of the Latino Business Action Network, which is an accelerator from Stanford University that helps Latino entrepreneurs grow their businesses. And we were talking for the podcast, and one of the things that he was saying, and it's related to some of the things that you just said, like, so a lot of people talk to me and say, come and tell us your story, Arturo, because we want to learn more about your story. And he said, I mean, I can tell you my story, but stories are cheap. You know, what else are you doing besides just telling your story? Those are important, right? But you only change something, a life of one person that actually listened to you in this day and age where we're all so distracted. When you have a leadership position and you affect policy, you change it for many other people, right? And so I think the invitation is to think about what currency do you have that you can spend to make a difference, right? Like what social capital do you have that you can use to make a difference for somebody else? The person that gave me my scholarship to come study in the U.S., he said he was a multimillionaire from Wall Street. And so I thought he was enormously generous, and he is. But he also is saving on taxes from paying for my education. So I think there's an advantage there too. But Shelby Davis is my idol. I will admit that. And what he said, his mantra for his family, it was the first 30 years of your life are for learning. The next 30 years are for earning. And then the 30 last years of your life are for giving, to other people. And I lived by that for the first 30 years of my life. I'm like, okay, I just got to study. And then I started working and I'm like, oh, I'm going to earn. And I'm like, but like, it might be too late when I start, to my 60s to start giving. So what can I do today to give back to my community, to do something different? And that's part of why this podcast was born, because I could wait or I could do something today. And I think that was a difference there. So now in your role as the chair of the Department of Chemistry, one of your responsibilities is to foster a positive and inclusive environment. And I'm going to go through some statistics right now. I looked at statistics from Rice University, and the Hispanic or Latinx population, student population, is at 11.8%. And that includes undergraduates, graduates, and part-time students. By comparison, all doctoral universities, the number of Hispanics is at 15.1%. So Rice is lagging behind a little bit. Comparing it to the state of Texas, where Hispanics or Latinos are the majority of the population, and the city of Houston, where Hispanics are the second largest minority group behind Caucasians, but only by 1%, right? So it's like 46 to 45%. It maybe doesn't make sense that Rice is lagging in Latinx population. So what do you think Rice University has to do in order to attract and enroll more Latinx students and come to par with other doctoral universities?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, these statistics are a reflection of certainly a larger, I would say, don't want to say problem, but a larger situation in our society, right? Mm. And in particularly Rice, Rice is a very pluralistic university. Mm. And when I say that, it's a really international university. The student body of Rice is not only Texan or it's not only from United States, but it encompasses, you know, the whole world. And when we think about diversity, certainly, we start to think about all diversity, right? Mm-hmm. So Latinos and African-American, Caucasians and people from Asia. Mm-hmm. People from Europe and people from Africa. And we talk about gender, right? So if you look at the distribution and this constellation of different races and different people from different countries, I think the Rice University, you know, give or take, is doing great. But I completely agree with you that the proportion of Hispanic Latinos can be increased. And I think that in many ways it's related to the community, to spread the word that Rice University is a place where you can come and do your studies. So you can come to do your college education, or you can come and do your master or your PhD here. And create awareness, spread the word that we are here. I think that we are very well known in Texas. The people in Texas know what Rice University. We would like all places to know where is Rice University and what do we do, what we are good for. Mm-hmm. And part of that is my mission, particularly about the chemistry department.
Yeah.
How can we make bridges to other places so that they know that Rice exists? Last week, I was in France and we were talking about that. Raul was in Mexico a couple of days ago, doing this kind of like connections, trying to spread the word. And how do we, you know, a big responsibility for me as chair of the chemistry department, how do we make the chemistry department an inclusive place and an equitable so that students from different places feel welcome?
Right. Yeah. And part of that, right, is I didn't know about Rice University when I was applying to grad school. And in fact, I don't really think I knew about many universities. When I was applying to grad school, I thought, you know, I'm going to apply to the University of Florida because that's where I'm doing my undergrad, right? People do research here. And really all I need is to stay in the country because I just needed, you know, more opportunities to get a visa later. But Rice is a private university, right? And there is a misconception that you have to have $40,000 or more to come and study at Rice. What kind of financial support does Rice provide to students who might think that, you know, it's overpriced and they won't be able to pay for it?
Yeah. So Rice, a couple of years back, started this program that is called the Rice Way. And the Rice Way means that they will cover all the financial need of the student or supplement the financial needs of the student based on what the family income is and everything. So that's for college. For PhD is less complicated because for PhD, we actually pay students to do their PhD. So the stipend for a Rice student today is $35,000 and the tuition is covered. So it's a good deal to actually do the.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when I was going through grad school, which was 2011 through 2016, our stipend was a solid $20,000 a year. And, you know, we made it work. You know, like I said, you have that chip, do you activate it, you make it work. $30,000, $35,000 sounds a little better. But I think what makes a difference is the differentiator in your career afterwards, right? So with that, I'm going to open it up to the audience and see if anybody has a question that they want to ask Dr. Marty, and then we'll go from there.
I have a question.
You have a question?
Well, what's the biggest challenge that you have to overcome during your PhD studies? What was that thing that was like, just going to quit, forget about it? And
yeah, the qualifying exams were tough. I think that was the part that I thought, well, I don't know if I will be able to make it. But it worked out, right? So apart from that, you know, the laboratory itself, part of the laboratory were not in good condition. So
not if you guys exploded the hoods every time with either.
Well, first of all, First of all, that was a temporary space. So then we moved to the new lab that was renewed. But I have always been a spectroscopist. And so they decided, I don't know who decided this, to put the fluorometer right underneath of the AC unit. It will literally will rain on top of the fluorometer.
Right.
And that was every day. So I just wonder if those optics will have mold or something, because the humidity in that room was like 300%. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it was awful. But when I was there, that was something that we will face every day. And that was challenging.
Good question. So Angel, you took the leadership position of being chair of the chemistry department recently. So I'm guessing you still have fresh those situations in which the expected things happen, but maybe you found a bunch of unexpected situations, cases to deal with now as the chair. Can you share some of those with us?
No.
Yeah, the unexpected are the most interesting ones, and maybe the ones that I should not talk about. But being department chair is extremely interesting because finally you get to know everything that happens. So when I was a professor, I didn't know any of the details, right? I knew that the department would run, that somebody would keep the lights on and the water running, right? How does this happen? What is the machinery that is behind it? And how complex that machinery is? It's incredible, right? Actually, it's somewhat a miracle that all these things can come together and are working at unison to actually make the department work. And it is really the people, right? You have good people in places and you trust them. We have fantastic chairs of the committees. We have fantastic staff that keep everything running. And when you have people that you can trust, then I think that things just work out. So yeah, but I would like to come to something that Jenny asked. How do you get to be a department chair? Because you said that it's important to know the route, right?
Yes.
What advice do you have to people? So just to ask to the audience, how many of you want to be department chair? Great. Because let me tell you this, if I would be sitting with you there, I wouldn't raise my hand either, because I never thought that I would be department chair, right? But why do you get chosen to be department chair? Well, I don't know either, because sometimes you have to be at the right place at the right time. And that's true with everything. But I think that there are things that you can do if you want to be department chair or if you want to be in leadership positions, right? Mm-hmm. And what I would say is that start small, be honest. People like honesty. Mm-hmm. Be smart about honesty too. But
strategic, right?
Be strategic about that. But for me, for example, I was at some point when you are getting to the last years of an assistant professor and first years of associate professor, then you probably will be called upon to be chair of one of the committees. And all the way to assistant professor, I was in the graduate committee, but not chair as the graduate committee. I was in the seminars committee. I was in the admissions committee. But by the end, then I was called to be the chair of admissions. And then I said, well, I'm gonna be the chair of admissions. Mm-hmm. Then I'm gonna be the best chair that I can be. So I started to analyze the admissions committee. What can we do to improve the admissions process? How do we spread the word? We started visiting places. We started to advertise the chemistry department in a different way. We started to expand our Gulf Coast Undergraduate Research Symposium to more universities to bring more undergraduates to present here at RISE, and that so that they get to know RISE. And I think that, you know, that I did well enough that people started to notice. And that was just part of it. Because at the end of the day, it is something that you said as well. How do you make connections and how people get to know you and the impression that people have about you? And yes, you had to talk to your colleagues. You had to talk to people. You had to get involved. And for me, you know, at the end of the day, when I was asked to be chair, there were three candidates in the faculty. I was one of them. And I think, honestly, that any of the candidates would have been a terrific chair. I got to do it.
Yeah.
And someday they will get to do it.
Yeah.
And someday many of the people that are in the audience as well, they will get to do it too.
Yeah.
So quick advice, if you ever are in this position or if you're ever asked, call your mentors. Mm-hmm. Ask them you know, is this something that I should do? If I do this, what it will take from me? What will be it requires from me? What are the things that I should expect? But the most important thing is that you need to have someone that you can exchange ideas and that will keep you grounded. And for me, that is my wife. I talk to her every day and I ask her, you know, that she's, I think that she's the chair of the department. In Spanish, there's a say that behind every great man, there's a great woman. I think that that's completely wrong. And I'm a little bit sexist as well. I think that, you know, next to every person, there needs to be another. And that doesn't have to be a spouse or, you know, but you have to have a network and you have to have people that have your back and people that will keep you grounded and that will be honest with you when you need honesty too.
Yeah.
And that will tell you, you know, you're taking on too much. You need to rest. You need to take it easy or you need to work harder.
Yeah. They call it your executive board, right? So if you, Angel Marti, was a corporation, corporations have executive boards to give them advice, right? And to sound advice and to help them understand these ideas. So in the corporate world, they call it having your own executive board for who you are. And it's people that you trust and it's people that you know want the best for you also. Not everybody wants the best for you and not everybody gives the advice that it's in your benefit also. So it's hard. I think, I don't think I have a board. I have a spouse that I also talk to and a few friends that I can call and ask questions. But I think throughout the development of one's lives and careers, I hope you get there. I don't know. I'm not there yet. Any other questions?
Yes.
Are there any plans being worked on or in motion or coming down the pipeline to help continue to increase diversity or accessibility to the department?
Yeah, some of the things that we want to do is to continue, for example, facets and make sure that we can still have the activities that facets sponsored. I think that's incredibly important. And there are a variety of other things. As I was saying, we need to reach out to different communities. We need to make sure that people understand that we are here and that we are a place where if people come here, they will be not only great, they will flourish. And we are waiting for, actually, we are in season. We are in recruiting right now. Mm-hmm. So if there's students, undergraduate students in chemistry that will listen to this pod later and would like to know a little bit more about grad school, reach out.
Always available. Yeah. And if you know anybody that's interested of joining the chemistry department at Rice, share the podcast with them so that they can have more insights as well. So with that, I'm going to ask you the last question. It's the same question we always ask at the end of the podcast. And so imagine a friend of yours is coming to visit, but unfortunately you are traveling. Maybe you went to Paris with the university to schedule a symposium over there and you won't be able to show them around. What are the top three places you would recommend for them to visit or top three things to do so that they can have a good time from a local point of view in Houston?
Yeah. So I love Herman Park and I certainly love the zoo. And they have very, very nice exhibits. In Herman Park, they have a beautiful place that's called the Japanese Gardens. Completely beautiful. So I recommend people to go there. I love NASA. The Space Center and the tours is just fantastic. But Houston is one of the most diverse cities in the United States. Mm-hmm. So in terms of food, there's so much good food that you have to take advantage of that. So for high-end restaurants, we like a restaurant that's called Hugo's. Another one that is called Lucius. Mm-hmm. Those are fantastic restaurants.
Excellent.
There's not a lot of Puerto Rican restaurants in Houston, but there's some food trucks that Puerto Ricans like La Garita. And so those are good too.
Yeah. Well, Angel Marti, thank you for joining us in the podcast today.
Thank you for listening. If you want to put a face to the voices you just heard, follow us on Instagram at LatinxCan or find us on LinkedIn as LatinxCan Podcast. If you have questions or feedback, you can email us at latinxcan@gmail.com. And if you want to support our project, please leave a review. We have made it easy for you and added the links to the show notes. That's it for now. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button. And remember, unidos somos más.